This is Ellen S. Swendon, and I'm interviewing James Boyd in Carmel on November, what are we, November
7th?
November 8th,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
This, I think, is our seventh interview session.
Well, I have no plans to leave Kennecott at all. It never occurred to me that in the early 1960, an executive recruiting service came to me and wanted me to consider the presidency of the Copper Range Company.
Now, this is in New York City.
This was in the world where you're still in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I had described the process by which the government had helped me get the company to get started. With this new ore body at White Pine, and put it into production. This was as late as the 1940s. I was in the late 1940s. I was aware of the technical and financial difficulties we had to face when deciding it was the public interest to put that mine into production. That's all described in this book of the Newcomen Society on Copper Range. So when they came to ask me to do it, I thought that this is a tough job, even though we thought it was a mine which should be put into production for the war effort. This was during the Korean War. It didn't occur to me that it would be a viable financial operation.
So you knew what you were getting into.
Not all entirely. But Ira Girolamon, who you know about.
Oh yes.
Was a distinguished geologist and a member of the Copper Range Board.
Mm-hmm.
He came to see me and showed me the reports of the discovery of the higher grade ore body of larger size in the mine. It's an ore body that covered a vast area. It does. It's still there.
Where exactly is it?
It's south of Houghton, Michigan, along the shore, not inland from the shore of Lake Superior, about 90 miles. A town called Onondagan, that's just in between. But the town now is called, it's an incorporated town of White Pine, which was the mining camp when I got there.
Mm-hmm. And the ore body is different from some of the other Michigan ore bodies, isn't it?
Well, the main Michigan, what caused the mining of copper were the vein deposits of native gold, of copper. That it was mined in sheets of copper. In fact, it was very difficult to mine because you can't blast it. It just bends.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to mine around it and take out these big hunks of metal and sometimes expensive to mine for that reason. But the White Pine ore body, it goes back to Precambrian days, and it was laid down in shales. And the minerals there were largely chalcocite, which is a high-grade copper mineral, and with certain amount of natural silver and natural copper, native silver and native copper.
Mm-hmm.
And it's therefore bedded, laid down in beds, and you have to mine it somewhat like coal. You're mining, a seam out of the bedded deposits in there, so it was a more difficult job than normal mining, because
mm-hmm.
the big open pit mines out of the porphyry coppers are mined with the steam shovels at the surface. The only underground mine of any importance in the southwest is down in Arizona at the one that Newmont has.
Magma.
That's an underground operation.
Okay. So when was it that Ira came to talk to you?
That would have been in the early months of 1960. Mm-hmm. I went to work for Kennecott in 1951, in August of 51. And I left it in June of 61. 60. Mm-hmm. So I was with him for 9 years. Mm-hmm. So this would have been in the early months of 60. Anyway, I went home and talked to Ruth about it, and she said to me, she said, I don't know what the new job is. I can't pass any judgment on that. You'll have to come to this conclusion yourself. But she said, I know that what you've got to do is you can't stay where you are. It's destroying you. Now, that was because they asked me to come in and build an enormous exploration department. And I was trying to get them to go into minerals other than copper, because I could see the problems with copper. I laid out all of the minerals which could provide a mining operation for Kennecott that would affect their balance sheet. It's like the oil companies going into copper. I never understand why they would do that, because the biggest mines in copper wouldn't be a touch on their incomes from oil, or the way it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's mm-hmm. anymore. They found that out now since they took over the Anaconda and Atlantic Richfield took over Anaconda, and Standard of Ohio took over Kennecott. And so on. The Phelps Dodge never got taken over. But these people, the big oil companies that did take over some copper operations, have either sold them off or put them in. I think Kennecott's still going on one of the five mines. So I thought we ought to be branching out, and I wrote a long report to the president suggesting to him that these are the things we can do. I never got an answer to that report. Anything I wanted, I'd suggest we do, was blocked somehow or other. So the only thing we ever started from all the things we discovered in our exploration department in Kennecott was a lead zinc mine down in Missouri, which I think, as far as I know, is still running. We found phosphates in North Carolina, or that area, and that eventually went over to somebody else that we never went ahead and did anything with it. I tried to get them into asbestos in Greece, and I got turned down on that too. So almost everything I wanted to do was turned down. I went to them, suggested we get into gold. Well, now I got told that gold was a fixed price, and therefore we waste our time trying to get into gold. Well, great mistake that was. We should have been into the gold fields, which Copper Range got into later on, when I was president. So it was during that time that we got into. I'm getting ahead of myself here.
Okay.
So then I began to think about it a little bit, and I began to realize this was important. Girolamo and now convinced me that there was a place there to do it. It wasn't going so well for me in Kennecott, so I thought that it's about time I got out. I went to talk to Mr. Cox, asked permission to come and see him. Remember, I was only one of two vice presidents of that great big corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I couldn't walk in and talk to him at any time. I just had to wait for him to find time to talk to me. So I went right ahead and negotiated the contract with the acting president of Copper Range, who was a partner in what's the name of the big financial firm, Payne Webber Jackson Curtis, and he was married to one of the daughters of one of the original founders of Copper Range Company. His name is Nelson Darling. And I negotiated with him, and I went up to Boston and met with the board, and they accepted my terms, which were fairly moderate, I guess. But they gave. I was by this time 55 years of age, so I had only 10 years to go, and they couldn't put me into their regular their retirement fund, so they had to write me a contract. So. I've still been supported by that contract, even though it's been sold out to somebody else.
Now the headquarters, the office was still in Boston.
Still in Boston.
That time.
This by this time was the last mining company left in Boston. The rest of them moved into other places and immediately New York, and it was quite obvious to me that there was no place for me to operate from, and I said to the board, I come with you on condition that I move the office to New York where I can work with the rest of the industry. And they agreed to that, too.
I know that Calumet was in Boston because of Agassiz's connection.
That's where that was the original source of funds for the copper industry in the United States.
Right.
And but it gradually moved into New York or out to San Francisco and places like
mm-hmm.
that, so that there wasn't anybody else. You just didn't have a mining community in Boston. There was a small office in Boston that was somebody from Calumet had to be there occasionally, but it wasn't an office that worked
mm-hmm.
anymore.
So this was really the last?
It was the last of the copper companies in Boston. So within in about a year's time, I had arranged for space in Rockefeller Center, and I moved the headquarters down there.
Mm-hmm.
And the only one I took from Copper Range, that from Kennecott, I don't know whether you want to cut this off the tape.
As you wish.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like this.
Maybe.
Well, that's probably true. But I don't like to say things like that in public.
No.
I've never said it to many people. But
not
it's
your style not, at all, is it? No.
Well, I hope not. Well, on the other hand, sometimes you don't tell the truth, too. And you try to get... well, we'll see how this comes out, because
okay.
Now we're getting into the Copper Range, because I really have to go through it to be able to give you any idea of what actually happened.
Now, you did take... somebody with you. You were
starting my secretary. She didn't come with me until I moved the office to New York,
mm-hmm.
and then I had a secretary and who had been there right along, but she didn't want to move to New York either. So it fitted nicely to bring Jean into.
What was Jean's
her name?
Last?
Was Jean Arre, Arre.
Mm-hmm.
She'd been my secretary from the time I came to Kennecott.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very close, and then she ended up by being the assistant secretary of Copper Range when I left. So,
mm-hmm.
She was with me for 20 years.
Another example of your skill at using people well.
Well, she was a wonderful person.
Mm-hmm.
She was a blue nose,
mm-hmm.
and she had a marvelous grasp of the English language, and I never let anything go out of that office. That Jean wasn't the last to see it, printing or a proofreading or like that. But I used to say, well, now why don't you write this letter for me? She says, Mr. Boyd, she said, I can write get the English correct. She said, I can't create letters. That's the way she put it. So she never actually. I couldn't just say to her, you write John Jones and tell him to go to hell. You have to dictate it to her.
Uh-huh.
But nevertheless, she would do a catch. And I don't ever know anything ever got out of that company that wasn't a letter perfect, which are annual reports and things like that, which is, doesn't even happen in books today.
No.
So,
so this move then didn't mean moving your house again. You could
that wasn't the reason I didn't go, but no, we had this very big house in Greenwich.
You had mentioned
And Ruth was just, this was her house, and she was thoroughly enjoyed being there. And we'd been there for some years before while
now,
we were kind
of. Was Ruth active in the Women's Auxiliary?
Yes, she was a member of the Women's Auxiliary from the time we were in Denver before the war. My mother taught her to do that, and so she'd always been active in going to the meetings and so forth. And so she knew how it operated, and when it came time, they elected her the president, and they kept her on. So obviously she did a pretty good job. I remember once going down to St. Louis to give a talk to the AIME, and she went down the same time, and she had to give a speech first. And I'd never heard her talk before, and my hands were moist, and I was nervous as a red hen. And she got up there, and that's a charming way of hers. She told interesting stories and got a little amusing. She kept it very short, and it was a wonderful speech. And I had to follow that act. It wasn't so easy. And, so that's how she then she became president. They wanted to keep her on for another year, but she wasn't feeling well. She began to lose. She was back. She was in Washington by this time. And her strength was beginning to fade, I think. And and I think the trauma of moving from that house in Greenwich down to Washington had some effect on her.
Yeah.
In fact, it was 6 months there. I don't think she was very happy with me.
Yeah.
And I didn't really quite realize. She never let me know. But then she began to enjoy Watergate. And I was elected to the Academy of Engineering, and she held a tea party there for the ladies visiting, which she couldn't do today because of a much bigger organization it was there. And she got to be quite active in that operation, so, in the BAR. So, well, we've gone off that.
Okay.
Now, going back to Copper Range. The problem with Copper Range is that they were far too short of people experienced in the mining industry to operate. Maurice LaCroix, who had been president at the time that we negotiated the deal with him, when I say we, in the federal government, and I was the agent of the federal government then, picked up this arrangement. He was the president. And he brought it down, and we negotiated with him. The contracts were signed by the General Services Administration, but we in the Defense Minerals Administration had to negotiate the deal. They had another young man who's the son of a very famous mining engineer, too, was president for a while, but he just didn't make it up. And they replaced him by Maurice LaCroix died. And they replaced him by the man who ran the Hussey operations, which were the fabricating facilities in Pittsburgh. And he had no experience in mining at all. And of course, he was trying to get this operation of White Pine going. And it needed a mining engineer. It needed people who understood mining. So that's why they came. In the meantime, they made Pete Lally, who was a president of Hussey, to the president of Copper Range. And apparently they felt that he just didn't have the experience to be able to handle that operation, so they went looking.
Now, one of the current management theories, I understand, is that management is management, and it doesn't matter whether you're managing a mine or a fabricating plant or a shoe store.
I think it's the problem of the American industry.
If you've had the few courses in management at Harvard, that you can manage anything.
That's what they think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
My second son, Bruce, Bruce is an MBA.
Mm-hmm. That's supposed to open the doors to anything.
That's supposed to. I think he's well trained in business. But nevertheless, those companies that are run by the mining industry began to be run by lawyers after a while. You know, there were a lot of lawyers. People like Monroe from Phelps Dodge was mm-hmm. a lawyer, and true, he was an honor graduate, a Rhodes Scholar. And he was a professional basketball player too. And I don't know whether he's still chairman of the board now or not. He was but nevertheless, you had to have mining men around you. And I think this was Mr. Cox's problem. He was then president of one of the subsidiaries of U.S. Steel. And his knowledge of the way you handle the technology of copper was entirely different than the way you handle steel. And the marketing system was entirely different. So I don't think he did it. I mean, I don't think it was hard for him to do it. And he didn't have the kind of people he needed in Copper Range to help him with it. And I recognized that as soon as I got to Boston. The sales manager was a man that was put in by Pete Lally, and they were great friends, and he resented my coming in. I had a hard time getting him around, but we ended up being close friends. Mm-hmm. He was a very good sales manager. He knew the industry, the consumption industry very thoroughly. He had made friends throughout the industry. So we always got our share of the market for 10 years I was running the company, or 11 years.
Had you gone to Michigan and visited the mine at the time that you took it over?
No.
No.
No. No, I had, but I'd had all the maps, mm-hmm. the geology, and I'd studied all that, and I'd studied the history, and of course I'd studied a lot of it before
mm-hmm.
This happened. I mean, getting after this contract, I had five mining engineers go up there and go over it, and three of them voted against it, and two were for it, and I had to overrule them.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Douglas was my assistant director of the Defense Minerals Administration at the time. That's Lou Douglas's brother. Mm-hmm. He came from Arizona. And between the two of us, we decided that we needed the copper bad enough, and it's the one place we'd get it better than anywhere else quickly. And so we approved the contract.
Mm-hmm.
Not because we thought it was a good financial deal for the stockholders, but because the country needed the copper. Or might need it if the corium war broke into a more widespread. We didn't know whether that's going to spread out to be another major, say, the Third World War.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to be prepared to get copper flowing again.
So it was at the Korean time that they borrowed this money?
Yes, it was. The White Pine Mine was expanded. In answer to the question of copper supply for the Korean War.
Okay, and they got the money from the RFC.
They got money from RFC, and they got everything we could do to give them help, which is
mm-hmm.
a rapid amortization.
Mm-hmm.
When I came in there, but one of the first things I do is to finance it privately, mm-hmm. pay off RFC, and have it financed by the insurance company.
This was one of the things.
I think $65 million I borrowed on occasion.
Mm. And that was one of the things that you instituted then, was that?
The paying the debt off, yeah.
Getting the debt paid.
Well, I got some encouragement from RSC. They wanted to get out of business too.
Mm-hmm.
It was the obvious thing to do, and I mm-hmm. had to negotiate with the New York Life.
Had they been having labor troubles at that time when became president?
Yeah, we had troubles all of them. We had steel workers in there. And they shut us down for 8 months, you know. The copper industry was shut down for 9 months. I settled a month early. And the trouble was, the man we had to deal with up there was just simply didn't know how to come to a conclusion. I finally went down to meet the president.
The union leader.
Union leader. Mm-hmm. He was a Finlander, trained in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
He had a, I tried to make friends with him and try to get him to understand what the problems were. I didn't want to interfere with the people on the job. But so I went down to make friends with, I mean, to talk with the president of the steelworkers, I.W. Abel, and we became good friends.
Mm.
He later became a ambassador to the United Nations, and he was responsible for keeping the steel industry out of strikes for what, years, and he made the contracts that permitted that to happen, that going to strike. And he told me the difficulty was they didn't have enough money to train people to do the negotiating. He couldn't do it himself, and they'd insist on doing the whole copper industry at once. And each copper, rather than dealing with one particular operation or mine which had different problems than others, they wanted a contract for the whole industry, the way they'd had to do it with steel.
Mm.
And so those long strikes were, well, I had then planned to go out and get into aluminum. And I had an arrangement with a company down, one of my customers, that we would put together a plant. They would run an aluminum plant, or a fabricating aluminum, and we'd come in. But the strike just cleared me out of any surplus capital to do it. So we couldn't take our share.
That's why Copper Range to go into the aluminum.
He wanted us to take over the supply of and so forth, and he had some confidence in me as a,
mm-hmm.
one of his suppliers. I supplied him with copper,
mm-hmm.
But the strike drained us of the capital we could
and
afford.
And this was an industry-wide strike then.
Yeah.
Arizona, Montana, as well.
Yeah, the whole thing. Arizona, Montana, Utah, everything. We were down for almost 9 months, 8 to 9 months. I've forgotten now exactly the thing, but I would have to look all those things. What I'm talking about is the competence in the industry. And obviously the board had recognized this. One of the members of the board was a Payne. He was the son of the original Payne.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a stockbroker. He didn't really know much about White Pine or the mining operations. There was a geologist on the board who was very useful.
Now, was Iris still on the board?
Iris on the board.
Mm-hmm.
No, was he on the board? I can't remember when he got off.
Well,
he got off for some reason. No, he was off before this picture was taken.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another Payne came on board at that time, a younger man. But that was the board later on, near the end of my tenure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the manager of the mine itself up there, under Mr. Lally had put in there, was the a man who had been with the copper range for years, almost all his life. And he was the land man. They had vast forest reserves that they had taken up in order to be able to have the mineral rights as well as the some holding the land by... We had five foresters in there selling the trees on the stump.
And they were exploiting the forests
at
that time.
Yeah, we were using them. That's right. Later on in my day, and this man I'm talking about, we decided we'd go into the milling business, and we set up a mill to take the lumber coming out of our forests and cutting it up to the specification of the furniture manufacturer. So you didn't have to ship them logs, you shipped them the pieces of wood that we cut to the right size for their chairs and their whatever else they were making, their furniture they were making.
Which, of course, they would pay more for.
Yes, but it was cheaper
right.
delivered than it would be because they had the disposal problems, sawdust, mm-hmm. and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And we took all that sawdust made up in doing this and sold it to a pulp mill where they made paper out of it.
But no one had thought of doing this before you got there.
No, I think it was a standard thing, but we hadn't been done up there.
Mm-hmm.
So we built this plant.
Mm-hmm.
Louisiana land later sold it off, but that was this man who was running the White Pine, and he simply hadn't any knowledge. For instance, the safety engineer was a bus driver when I got there. He had no more idea what about safety, and they how the building the Nichols I was telling you just telling you about it. Well, at least I got to wipe his wife. He died the other day.
Mm.
He didn't know. He hadn't got the concept that safety in a mine is one of the most important things you do. You know, Lang knows all about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was only two mining engineers in this great big mine, one of the most difficult mining operations in the world. And there was a metallurgist in the smelter. There was a mill man, a graduate engineer in the mill, and that was the substance of the staff. And we needed all kinds of. We needed a foreman on each, or at least an assistant manager on each of the shifts in the various parts of the mine. And we needed, for instance, when I got there, I think something like 50 or 55% of the mining machines were down, lack of maintenance. There was not a mechanical engineer in the place to maintain this stuff. There was no regular system of taking machines out of operation for preventive maintenance. So, then I got a hold of Jimmy Richardson. Have you ever met him?
Yeah.
Yeah. He was with a company in San Francisco at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I got him to help me recruit.
Well, I guess it's the same one who was later with the Bureau of Mines.
Well, he came in to be with me in the Defense Minerals Administration. No, he wasn't with the Bureau of Mines.
I know Jim Richardson, who I think was from Arizona. Might be a different one.
James K. Richardson.
Oh.
Well, he used to work for Kennecker.
Oh,
he was assistant superintendent at Chino.
Okay, it's
yeah.
the same one.
You must know, he knows everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got a nice letter for him the other day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, I said, the first thing I need is a safety engineer. And he found me an ideal man, little fella. But on the hand, immediately I said to this to Larry Garfield, the mine manager, this man reports to you, not to any machine, anything he sees wrong with safety, he has access to me if necessary. Got the total authority, you've got my authority to do what is essential. Well, this man turned out very well, and our safety went down from one of the worst in the mining industry to the one of the top ones.
That is your accident rate.
Accident rate.
Yes, you won. You were awarded the big one year. You got...
Soon after we began, mm-hmm. actually. The first year I got there, we had 5 fatalities. And this was the director of the Bureau of Mines, having 5 fatalities.
Mm.
That was no good.
Mm.
So that was the first thing I got after.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing we needed a
okay. There was no manager.
Well, there was
the property,
a. There was a there was no the manager
was doing everything.
He was running the whole operation,
oh.
Business and labor and everything else.
Oh.
Now this was a very fine man. I mean, we were very close friends. So when we found the man we wanted, he agreed to come. I called Bill and I said, you know, I'm going to have to relieve you. He said, well, I've been expecting it. Because I was, then I sent him up back to where he lives in his home in Michigan, and in Houghton. And he ran the land and he ran the Painesdale operation, which is also a small corporation up there. Yeah. We had to get him a manager for that one, so that he had a man who later turned out to be the general manager down at Newmont's operation in down which we mentioned it.
Magma.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't. Now all these fellows did very well that came out of corporate.
Mm-hmm.
They still do.
Mm-hmm.
So we had some very good people. Well, the first year we had a serious loss because we took all these machines out and we started repairing them and putting them in shape. The management was getting better. We went, all these things were going along, but everybody would walk across the street and they saw me coming so they wouldn't have to talk to me.
You did go up there?
No, that was in New York.
In New York, okay. Mm-hmm.
And, within 2 years, we were showing a good profit, and that's when they gave me that gold medal.
The Rand.
Yeah.
Medal. Mm-hmm.
But this, I didn't earn it except to get people to work.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I do know enough about mining, so I could see that the right, argue with them and press them and do the right thing.
And see what was going
on. I made some mistakes too, and I'll tell you about that.
Yeah.
So I think the first thing I did was to staff it.
Mm-hmm.
Then I realized that we had one of the most difficult mining operations in the world, and we needed to find new methods of doing of mining and to handling the ore. So we went in, I set up, I got the superintendent and the general manager up there to then set up three research divisions, one on the metallurgy, one on the mining methods and the handling and transportation methods, the other one on the mining method, the breaking method.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot of experimental work. And we even experimented with longwall. We hired rock mechanics. I have a fellow by the name of Jim Scott. Jim was at the meeting in Las Vegas.
Mm.
He was a professor at the Rolla School of Mines. And he was one of the first broad-scale rock mechanic students.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, his predecessors had recognized that we weren't going to run that mine by setting it up. It's an underground mine run like a coal mine, and the roof bolts had come in about the time this thing was opened, so those people who developed that mine developed the use of the rock ball. So that was there before I got there.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was the question about how long should we leave these openings open? How much of the ore should we mine? Or how much should be left in pillars? And we decided to cave parts of the mine. And from there on, we set up a rock mechanics group of people who've turned out very well in the field. And I think it was about the first in the mining where you went and how you mined it was the result of the solutions by the Rock Mechanics Research Group. And I think that's, as far as I know, the first time in mind of being an operator with that kind of, they could even go in and would go in and tell the men that this particular part of the mine would collapse at such and such a time of the day. In the early days, when they would say that, the men would be gone 1,000 feet down the drift. Then 500 feet, then 100 feet, and then they go. Pretty soon they kept on working. The rocks were all around their feet, and they know that they had confidence in these engineers that could tell them that by keeping track of the roof bolts and the pressures and the things like this that they could predict. So we began. This was near the end of my stay, so I don't know how long it went on after that now.
Now, this research group was made up of engineers.
Yeah, these were engineers who were trained in rock mechanics or mining engineers who understood rock mechanics.
And they reported directly to the manager?
No, they would talk to the manager of the mine, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was the general superintendent, general manager,
mm-hmm.
who was the head of the operations in White Pine. Then there was the mine manager,
mm-hmm.
and he had assistant managers, and then he had the research group, which reported to the general manager.
I see.
And, but they had to work together. I mean,
sure.
you couldn't work in a vacuum.
Now, was this the sort of thing you had learned from General Clay?
No.
No.
No. He might have learned it from me.
Okay.
If he ever had anything to do with it. No, what I learned from General Clay is how to be an executive.
Uh-huh.
How you got other people to do the things and knew who to go to do it and have judges as to whether they're being successful or not. Now, I told you the experience of my being asked to get the coal mining machinery over to England to keep the coal. Did I mention that when we talked about that? During my time in Clay's office?
When you were in Washington.
Yeah, before I went to Germany.
When you angered him. Was that the time?
Oh, no.
That was Chain.
Oh, I didn't mention that then.
Well, perhaps not.
Well, one day the executive director of the Board of Economic Warfare called me over and said, Jim, do you know about this problem about coal and not being able to get enough ships to move coal to England?
Yes, I think you did tell that.
Well, that,
yes.
Then that's there.
Yes,
well,
it is.
It isn't worth putting in later.
Okay, yes, but it is. Uh-huh.
But when he agreed to sign his letters, and he said, "Well, now you do it." See, and then what do I do? Go and try to do this myself? Well, I didn't have any authority. I didn't have anything to do. I went to the Corps of Engineers and worked it out with them, and they're the ones that did the work. The same way you do in any administrative work, you find out what the problem is that you need to solve. You find out how it's going to be solved, and then you've got who's going to solve it. And then you get out of the way. Let them do it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't stand hanging around. There are too many people, too many managers going to keep the decisions of their own men. My people used to say to me, "Well, now, what is it you want?" I said, "Look, I've given you a responsibility. You're the man responsible in this company for that particular responsibility. You tell me what's best for the company, not what I want.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I pay you for." And that's, amazingly few people know how to do that. And I think Clay's what taught me about that.
Mm-hmm.
He used to say to me, "If you issue an order down at the all these agencies that worked under General Clay's direction. You go down and you talk out that order with you, who's going to receive it before you issue it. You don't go down and issue orders without them having a hand in seeing that that is the kind of order that would produce the results you want produced. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the kind of thing that Clay would have taught me. It sounds simple now, but it took a while to get that through my thick skull.
Right. So that's the kind of thing you were doing at White Pine.
This is wherever you are after that. When I was in Germany running a very large operation of the reestablishment of German industry, I had to depend entirely on, for instance, this man up here, Walker Sisler, had charge of the electrical industry, or the power industry.
Mm-hmm.
He'd come in, I'd know certain things that needed to be done, but he'd come in and tell me what he was doing and so forth, and I'd ask him about it, and then he said, well, what do we do? And I said, well, we go and do it right now. And he would, and by the time anyone turned around, we had all the power systems in Western Europe connected. You'd never have done this in peacetime.
Hmm.
The politicians would never let you do it. They'd argue about it from six forever. And by the time the governments had reformed, their power structure was all worked out for them. And Walker did that. So he has acquired a gear and all everything else. He's got all kinds of metals. But it was Walker that did it, not me. Yet it was our division that did it.
Mm-hmm. Did you find, though, that when you got into industry that, or government, either one, after the army, that it wasn't quite so easy to get things done?
Oh, no, it's easier.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think one of the greatest shocks to me, really, was when I went from the Bureau of Mines and the Defense Minerals Administration to Kennecott, and they gave me a job of being the exploration manager, and I had to do certain things, and I would say, well, where's the money coming from?
Mm-hmm.
I'd go down and talk to the controller, and he just looked at me. He said, "You're an officer of this company. You're authorized to commit to the company funds within your jurisdiction." And it was hard for me to realize that I didn't have to go to Congress to get appropriation and stay within the appropriation and so forth. Now, I would get budgets, and I'd have to stay within the budgets, and then every year I had to go before the board to do it, but the same way with the copper range.
Mm-hmm.
If I had any major thing to do to take on, I would take it up at the next board meeting, and I had to be prepared, and they would be prepared to answer me questions from a business point of view. But they wouldn't gainsay my judgment of the engineering aspects of it,
mm-hmm.
or the economic aspects of that matter.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a controller in the company, which wasn't there when I got there. A financial man that I got recommended to me by the fellow who was later on the chairman of the board of the Chase Bank.
Mm-hmm.
He was my executive vice president up in Rockefeller Center, and I talked with him about it. They gave me stock options, and at one point I wanted to take up these stock options. To do that, I had to borrow $100,000. I thought that was all kinds of rigmarole. I called up and I said, "Bill, He said, when do you want it? I said, well, any time you can send it. I'll have it a check over for you in a half an hour.
Oh.
He comes to check for 100,000. I said, how about collateral? He said, when you get your stock options, turn them over to us. We'll keep in the bank for you. So you need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You pay them off. It's trust.
Yeah.
They knew me. The bankers knew me. They knew what my reputation was.
Mm-hmm.
They know that I wouldn't be doing anything crooked, and that I wouldn't be coming to them unless I had a good, sound financial reason to do it.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to the insurance companies to get the $65 million to clear off the bank, they investigated it, of course, but. They had complete confidence in what we did, and it didn't take us very long to raise $65 million. Seems easy. It took a lot of money. Even then, even today, it sounds like a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it was in those days a real amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's answering a question you said.
Right.
And I think that's very important from an administrative point of view, that you only make those decisions which your informants having trouble about, or got different opinions. Then you have to make a decision between them. And when you discuss it, you've got experience, and you're going to put that experience into the discussion.
Now, I was wondering if you wanted to say anything about your board, since you're talking about the board now. Did you have any input on selecting new board members, for instance?
Yes, I did, but it didn't change much all the time I was there.
And there was nobody on the board with mining?
Well, Gerolamon was on the board.
Oh, he was a geologist.
And there was another younger man who was a geologist.
Both geologists, then. No mining.
No, there was no mining. No, they were extraordinarily lacking in mining experience.
Even on the board.
On the board or in the company in the operating levels. We had a very small. I don't remember. I can't give you the exact figures, but we went from 3 or 4 engineers in the mining and operation up to 30 or 35 before we got through. And they were working on research, getting improved mining methods, and getting your costs down, and so forth.
So your board had to rely completely on your judgment for
absolutely
anything to do with
it. They were very good about it. I don't think they ever said no to anything I asked them to do. But I hoped I wouldn't go to them unless I had worked it out very thoroughly. There are things that did went wrong, but they never gainsaid me. They would ask some questions, but pretty tough ones to answer sometimes. But
they didn't really know anything about the...
Well, let's take a look at these people. Why don't we do that picture? Here.
Right there. We said there was a pain.
Yeah, this is... That was the older member of the Payne family. This is the younger one that came in later. This was near the end of the day. This was the chairman of the board of General Telephone. But he's a primary lawyer. This is an oil executive, Hadley Case. And he had a lot of stock in the company. And... I went on his board later on. This was one of the. This was a lawyer, a solicitor. I got to know the dean from Harvard Law School, and he'd been the Solicitor General of the United States. And he told me this was the smartest student he ever had when he was from the law school up there. This is the.
Do you want to mention their names?
For sure. If I can remember them.
Mm-hmm.
This is Hadley Case.
Mm-hmm.
These are the Paynes. This is Isn't that funny?
We can probably look it up.
Oh, I can do it because I look at it. But the name, before I go through, I'll remember it. This was the president, the owner of the New Mexican newspaper
in Santa Fe.
Santa Fe. This is the man who was running the company when they hired me. He's a top senior member of Payne Webb Jackson. That's Darling.
Nelson Darling.
This was the president of the Scott Paper Company, which later emerged onto another one. What's his name? Now here's the geologist. Here's Pete Lally, who's still on the board at this point. And here's the man who succeeded me as president when I left, when I retired. That's, isn't that funny, names won't pop in quickly. I don't know what's happened to my memory. Well, but I can give you a little bit. But now Chet was a geologist too. He's the geologist. But the rest of these were businessmen.
And lawyers.
Well, he's the best businessman in the crowd. I went and stayed with them in their house just the year before I met Timmy. I married Timmy. Isn't that funny? It won't pop into my mind. It's on the tip of my tongue.
Sure.
You were asking about the board. Well, the fact that the board would. I could go to the board, and I never went home on Friday unless I called Nelson up and tell him I was cooking. This man, Chet Ensign, his name was, who followed me, he got in trouble with the board because he never told them what he was doing. If Nelson would be the one would pass the word on to other members of the board he thought needed to know about something. But I never went home on Friday night that I didn't call Nell up and tell him what was I'd done or what was going on and what the things were going to be. And that was that relationship with the board was absolutely essential. I don't know how you get along without the relationship. And most of these things that you see with companies is where the management and the board get out of whack or the stockholders on me. But I never had any that kind of problem. Well.
And then you later went on some boards as a result of this.
Being on the board, yes. Well, for instance, Walker Sisley asked me to come on the board. Being in Michigan and his company being a Michigan company, and because I was on the board of Detroit Edison, I also got appointed as a director of the Detroit Economics Club. With all the other executives of the motor companies. One time I sat between another boy who was the president of Chrysler at that time, and the head of the one of the universities around there was Boyd, and then the Boyd who later on was president of the ran the government railroad was named Boyd, and they were all there, and one of them giving a speech.
Oh, same meeting.
same enormous room, dining room. We met once a month.
Mm.
And they always had a Detroit Edison board meeting at the same time, so we could all attend that economics club meeting. Mm.
What clubs did you belong to in New York?
I belonged to the Union League Club and the Mining Club.
Mm-hmm.
That's enough. Well, the Westchester Country Club.
Mm. But
now, in those days, it was all right. The Union League Club, I had to join myself. And then Cox wanted me, when I was with Connecticut, to go over to a new club they set up in the building across the street from us. And but he wouldn't want to pay my dues in there, but they were paying my dues of the Union League Club, and I begged off. That was a much nicer place to play.
And were you active in the AIME at this time? Did you have a local section office or anything like that?
Well, yeah, I was active, not extremely active.
Mm-hmm.
I never was on the board of the Society of Mining Engineers. I went in as their appoint. See, the four societies
mm-hmm.
nominate the president
of the AIME,
mm-hmm. and. There wasn't an election process simply. So I was put up by the Society of Mining Engineers in 1969. That's how I got to be president. Mm-hmm. And I really wasn't as an active member as I should have been. I didn't know much how the AIME ran.
Mm-hmm.
I would take part in meetings and things like that, but I never really held office. Until I was president.
Well.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That doesn't happen anymore.
No.
The presidents today, I think I was probably the last of the chief executive officers of mining companies that was president of AIME.
Mm-hmm.
From there on, it became, the president of, fellow related became president of, Exxon was the president of AIME. The great mining executives from Phelps Dodge and so forth all served the time, and I think I was the last of them.
Mm-hmm.
From there on, they grew up through the offices, the places in the four societies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it's a major tragedy, but. I fought against as long as I could.
Really? Why?
Well, because what's happened, the mining society has an office way out in the woods near Denver. The petroleum society, petroleum engineer, SPE, has it out in Dallas. The metallurgists are in. And where they are now. They're not in New York anymore. There's just a little tiny AIME headquarters in New York now. And the president, the executive secretary of AIME, is a secondary figure.
Hmm.
He's not like the executive secretaries had been up at that time.
In your day, the societies also had their headquarters in New York.
Yeah, the SPE was the first one to go out.
Mm-hmm.
The Metallurgical Society, the Mining Society, and the
Petroleum.
The Petroleum was in Dallas.
Yeah.
They went out before I was president.
And
the rest of them all had.
And were both still in New York. Mm-hmm.
Well, I may be wrong. I haven't, since I retired, I've been so busy, I've never had much time to worry about it.
Yeah.
I've been to the meet. Of course, I do go to the meetings, but I have been until I served in the church and couldn't go to the meetings. I will go to the meeting in February in Denver. Mm-hmm. And we always have a past president's meeting. Mr. Hoover used to come to that when it was in New York. Mm-hmm. We don't go to New York very often anymore. And we have a sort of a, we have no authority. We're not a, an official part of the AIME, but they always have a luncheon for us or a breakfast, in which we discuss the what's going on, and we make certain suggestions about to the new president coming in, and the new officers, what how you should handle problems, and they normally bring them to discuss before that group. But it doesn't do you any good to vote because you don't have any authority.
Mm. Well, of course, one of the things that's happened, maybe this is a place to bring this in, I reread this last week an article, which I'm sure you remember, from Business Week a couple of years ago, the death of American mining. Do you remember when that was their cover article? There were several articles in the papers and magazines at that time.
Yes, I can remember the period, yeah.
When,
yeah.
At the time that Anaconda and Kennecott and
went into
everything
the oil business,
was,
yeah.
was dying. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that has also happened. AIME is not a major organization anymore.
That's
I
right.
guess.
Well, you, the societies, they gang together. They don't really have. However, the result we've always pressured them, the past presidents, to realize that the strength of their all their strengths lies in the AIME. It has the basic legal authority. Now they've got separate corporations for the societies. And they're operated by their boards from where they are. But a large part of the money that comes to them outside of their own dues comes from the endowments in the AIME. Mm-hmm. And I've always argued that it's extraordinarily important for them to keep that, because then they speak with a much louder voice.
Three together.
Yeah, the four of them.
Four.
Mining Society, the Metallurgical Society, Petroleum Society, and the Iron Steel Society.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. But when they go off and have their meetings like that over at different times separately, now for instance, we go to the AIME proper meeting, there'll be very few petroleum people there. Now, you're getting an awful long way from that from me.
Well, I guess we are, really, but that's sort of interesting, I thought. Is there anything you should say at this point about how Ruth's life was changing along with yours? Was she...
Well, Ruth was a...
Did the change to...
Ruth had four children. I mean... And until we had Brown came along, she taught school too, and we.
Did she ever go up to Michigan with you, for example?
Oh yeah. Well, one time when this must have been a year after I'd been president. I took Jeanari with me, and because I wanted her to meet, she'd just better get settled. I wanted her to meet all the people, and so she could deal with them up in time. And I don't think I mentioned that Ruth was coming too. See, but they were great friends. Both of them ran me. I didn't have a chance. And The tongues began to wag. Here I was bringing my secretary up, and when they came to visit White Pine, showing her off and so forth. And then, of course, when Ruth shows up, and where she goes, Jean goes too, the chatter dies very quickly. But but remember that we'd been married 4 years before Brown came along.
Mm-hmm.
We were married 32. Between 4 and 5 years. And she was a devoted mother. She read their education, their welfare, and my welfare. She dedicated a whole life to that, to the children. But by the time we'd been in Greenwich, Hudson was still in grammar school. Doug was just in high school. And the other two were in college. So she was coming to the end of supervising and raising children. And I was concerned about that period. To me, that's the worst break for women. Is when they've devoted their whole life and concentrated on doing that, suddenly were they without it. That's when I kept not nagging her, but suggesting her that she take more time, active part in Wamey.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what helped that break. We entertained not a great deal, but fairly commonly. We had always had help in the house. We had this great big house on New Year's Eve.
So I wondered, you did a lot of business entertaining, of course. She did?
No.
No?
Not a lot.
Not a lot.
No. I wasn't a very good entertainer. I wasn't really in the business where we had two salesmen to sell $100 million worth of copper. Who do I have to sell to?
Yeah.